Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Voices for Change 2.0, the only podcast that focuses on mental health while mixing in movies, music, books, sports, and pop culture. Here are your hosts, Rebecca and Joe Lombardo.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us here at Voices for Change 2.0. We are glad to have you.
Hey, thanks for being with us this fine Saturday morning.
Chilly
Saturday morning in late April. Thanks, spring, for that. You know, I was really actually enjoying the warmer weather last week. So,
the irony is that
nice about face.
Michigan is being Michigan again, and we put in our window air conditioning unit last week and used it for one day, and then the next thing you know, we were freezing our tuchuses off. So
yeah, but you know that happens every year to us. You know,
yeah, it does.
We're gonna get rid of the room heater. We'll put the window unit in, you know, for the air conditioning because it's hell outside right now and it's really hot in here. And, you know, then all of a sudden it's like, okay, you've done that. Here's 40 degrees for you.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's just like I always say, Michigan being Michigan.
Yep.
So, hey guys, we just wanted to quickly say you are able to call in live to the show today. And we would love to hear from you. I'm sure our guests would love to field some questions. So give us a call at 347-989-0126. Or you can tweet questions using the hashtag VFChange. And I hope somebody will send us a question because the last time that we had audience participation, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So
it was great.
Enjoyed that. So today we're chatting with someone that I've had the pleasure of getting to know a little bit better this past week. And I'm glad that I did. He's a very cool guy. He's an author, a poet, a speaker for the National Alliance for Mentally Ill, and a cast member for a show called This Is My Brave. And if you're not familiar with that, we'll get into it a little bit later. And like I said, he's just kind of an all-around cool guy. So please welcome to the show, Joe Fusaro.
Good morning. Thank you guys very much. The intro was too nice.
Hey, Joe, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you guys for having me. How are you guys doing?
We are freezing, but hanging in there.
Yeah, we're huddled together with our hoodies on, and you know, just kind of chilly and whatnot. But you know, like my wife said, that's just Michigan being Michigan. So
yep.
I'm sure tomorrow it'll be 82 degrees, and we'll be sweating.
Sitting in sweat.
Yeah,
too.
If it makes you feel any better, it's raining and cool in New York too. So it's it's everywhere.
Okay,
it's not just there.
We're gonna ask where you were at. So
yeah,
cool.
I forgot from the other day. I forgot that you were in New York. So
yeah, I'm in Westchester, New York, which is just outside of this, just a little north of the city.
Oh, okay, cool.
If you don't have any questions for us, we're just gonna jump right into ours.
No, you guys do your show.
Alrighty. So let's start from the beginning. When did you realize that you were struggling with something, and what was your initial diagnosis?
I first noticed I was struggling back in elementary school. I always had trouble sleeping at night, and it would cause, like, during the day in school, I would be really fatigued. I would fall asleep in class. I wouldn't want to go to school. I would get anxious easily, but I never really went to anybody for help or anything. So it probably didn't like all catch up with me until I was at the end of high school, like the beginning of college. And my first diagnosis were ADHD, depression, and anxiety.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. So then that, that turned into more and more problems because I shouldn't have been on the controlled substances that were prescribed for those illnesses because I was bipolar the whole time. So then it wasn't until like my late 20s, early 30s that I was diagnosed with general anxiety and bipolar 1.
Wow, okay.
So yeah. You struggled for quite some time.
Yeah, it's funny. You guys, you and Beck are very similar in that endeavor. You know, she feels that, you know, her illnesses hit her very early on in life too, and wasn't actually didn't actually start getting diagnosed until, you know, around 19. And
yeah, I went through that, you know, terrified to go to elementary school, middle school, high school, just, and you know, I look back on it now, and at my high school, when you turned 18, you were allowed to call yourself out of school. Like ordinarily your parents would have to call
and say
that you weren't going to be there. But when you turned 18, you were allowed to do it yourself. And I look back on it now and I think, damn, why didn't I do that?
Yeah.
That really would have helped me out a lot.
I'm pretty sure I barely graduated. No, I think I barely graduated from absences. I had like 30 my senior year. So 30 late to school or absences in my senior year. And when we got to like the last month of the year, they were like, you have to be here every day or you're not going to graduate. And I was just I was so withdrawn. Like I was just over it, you know. I was just over all. I had things that I was dealing with in my own life that I was, you know, wondering like, why aren't I happy? Why don't I feel right? That like I wasn't really worried about school, you know. There's other things mm-hmm. that were more important at the time. So
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Did you have a supportive family during that time? You know, how did they handle what you were going through?
I did. I mean, my parents have always been supportive of anything I did, whether it's like sports, music, you know, friends, anything I wanted to do, they were supportive. I mean, they worked, my mother worked 12-hour days as a nurse, and my father was a carpenter during the day and then was a police officer at night. So they
Wow.
And honestly, when they came up to me, I mean, they probably approached me to see if I wanted help a bunch of times, but like, I wasn't very responsive when I was younger because I didn't think that, I thought that it would like, it would make a mess out of my life even more. You know, I didn't think that going to a doctor or trying medication or, you know, telling people that I had a mental illness, I didn't think that that would help. I really thought that that would throw a wrench into everything. And, you know, as a teenager,
right.
you kind of want to find as much stability as possible. So I think I was very resistant to any help that anyone that did offer me.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. It's funny that, you know, that you mentioned that because you know, I'm sure there was a part of you thinking, well, you know, this is just something that everybody goes through, you know,
exactly.
I'm no different from anybody else. You know, why, what do I need help for? I got this. I'll figure it out. You know, I'm new here, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, so what, you know, what finally changed your mind on that then?
Well, when I was in college, I had a friend that was like, I was having trouble studying. I was having trouble getting up on time for classes. You know, it was like a few months in and I was smoking weed every day. And, I was just like a mess. I was just a disaster, like within a couple months into college. And somebody was like, hey, like, you know, I take medication for that. It was called Adderall. And I was like, yeah, I'll try one of those. And they gave it to me. And I just started, like, doing all my work. Like, I was just like, this is amazing. I was like, I didn't know that they made a medication for this. So I was like, you know what? I was like, so in a way, it was good and it was bad. Because it showed me, like, hey, this kid, like, is dealing with his mental illness. And he doesn't care. He's just doing what he needs to do. So on that part of it, it was good. But, like, I didn't need to, like, try that med and then go to the doctor and ask for that med. Like, because that's not the way that it works. And So I went to the doctor thinking that all this, like, worked fine and everything was going to be great. And then a couple months down the road, like, I was totally addicted to Adderall and Xanax. And I spent most of my 20s struggling with that. That not only addiction, but like this physical dependence where like I could not get out of bed unless I had those meds. And it really, like, there were days where like it glued me to my bed. And then there was days that I was just like off the wall manic. And I fought with that for years, you know, quitting school, going back to school, getting a job, you know, within the first year I'd get promoted, everything would be going great. I'd be in a new relationship, I'd, you know, have a house, a car and everything. And then a year later, I'd lose everything. And this just kept happening throughout my 20s.
This is a vicious cycle, yeah.
Vicious. And I went to rehab a couple times and I would try their meds. But I would walk out of the rehab hospital with like 5 or 6 prescriptions. And I was like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Because, you know, I'm not on the controlled substance anymore, but now I'm taking like 2-3 times as many pills every day that don't make me feel good. So it's just, that was pretty much my 20s. In a nutshell.
Yeah. So when did you first realize that you had sort of a talent for writing?
I started writing songs. I was in a band when I was like 13 or 14. And we played like some covers and we wrote some songs. And whenever I was home in my room, like trying to practice what we were supposed to play at our next gig, like I would always end up like writing my own song. So it was like I always had this maybe I was a bit too much of a perfectionist, but I was like this is how like this should go, you know, or like this is how this feels better to me. And so I started writing, you know, simple like verses and choruses and stuff like that. But then I loved putting lyrics to it. Like that was my favorite part because I liked to like narrate the sound or like the, you know, like the atmosphere, the vibe that like that sound gave off. So
That's very cool. And off, when we're not doing the show off time, you and I need to talk music.
Definitely. It's my favorite topic to talk.
Yeah, you and me both. And yeah, I'm kind of fiending for some good musical conversation. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, he doesn't really get it from me, although.
I'm better
than I used to be.
She is. I gotta give her credit. She has put up with so much of my musical crap that
he'll quiz me on guitarists and stuff like that.
Not as much anymore.
Well, it's because we never actually see anybody. He likes to do it like I'm a circus clown, I'm a circus seal or something, and you know. Sit up and clap for everybody, honey.
Oh, I thought you meant you were really in the circus.
No.
God, no. I hate clowns.
Come on, honey. Name all of Ozzy's guitarists. Come on, you can do it.
Yeah.
He likes to do that in front of other people. So.
Well, and she knows. I'm just proud of her because she, you know, she knows. But
yeah,
it's
awesome.
It's kind of I can't talk today. I have relaxed on that a little bit because I'm starting to realize that maybe it's a little embarrassing to her.
Yeah. So,
she knows who Zach Wilde and a whole bunch of other people are, and that makes me proud. So
Randy Rhoads.
Great. Awesome. See, huh? See what I mean?
Yeah. some of the best relationships are formed over music. You know, it's it brings people together. It has been forever.
Yeah, we share some of the same likes, but there's a couple of things that he listens to that I just cannot get behind. And
she really hates Iron Maiden.
I hate Iron Maiden. And I don't know if you're familiar with Dream Theater, but
I know of them because I won't go into it. But I know who Dream Theater is.
I love me some Dream Theater and some Iron Maiden, and she just
you
can't
really,
get behind
I have
it.
Some friends that you would love.
Cool. So, hey, Joe, do you still seek treatment out today?
Yes. Yeah, I see a therapist/doctor every month and once a month.
Great.
And, he's just somehow I got down to one med. You know, over the past, after I was hospitalized probably like 9 or 10 times, about between 2007 and 2013 was my last hospitalization. And yeah, when I first came out, I had to see somebody like every other week. I had to see a doctor and a therapist. And then I found one guy that does doctor and therapy. And I've just been seeing him once a month for the past couple of years. And, everything seems to be working, so I'm sticking with it. You know, I'm not going to give up now.
That's great.
Yeah, my last hospitalization was 2013 as well, so
yeah.
We also have that in common. Did you find that any of the psychiatric hospitalizations were a benefit to you?
That's
a loaded question.
Yeah. A benefit, like, I mean, I was extremely manic and psychotic most of the times when I went to the hospital. So did it stop me from being manic and psychotic? Yes. Did the meds do more harm than good in the long run sometimes? I would have to say yes. I mean, there was a med, which I don't know if you guys throw meds out on your show, because I don't want to persuade or dissuade anybody from, you know, going with something.
Everybody likes to hear the experiences that others have had with meds. So
yeah, absolutely. Don't be afraid to talk about them. You know, it's,
I haven't been on this in a while, but they gave me shots of haloperidol probably like 6 years ago or so, and they continued to give it to me for like a year or two, when I knew from the beginning the problem was that I was taking Adderall. So if I'd stopped taking the Adderall and taken just like something to sleep and another antipsychotic like Seroquel or something, I knew that I would be fine. But they gave me the haloperidol to like get me down from the Adderall, which that it did really fast. But then like they kept giving it to me even when I stopped taking the Adderall. So I felt like that was like an overkill. And that was honestly the most uncomfortable and like painful like 2 years of my life, was being on that shot of Haldol once a month. I feel like I'm like gasping for air right now, because like my muscles were like, they just felt like they were melting, and I couldn't think. Like it stopped like all thought, so like there was really no way to get better. Like it got me down from the high, but there was no way for me to get better on it, because like I couldn't even think about good things or like having goals or making progress or forming relationships, like all these things that you need to incorporate into your recovery, I wasn't able to do. So
it's almost like a mental straitjacket.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That was exactly it. I was just numb. I was numb. I didn't want to do anything. Like I would even, the one thing I would do every day is I couldn't wait, like the mornings that I knew that there was like a Met game on that night, I would put the TV on and I would get, it was like 7 o'clock that night, I would get to like the third inning and I couldn't even like enjoy watching something that I've done every night of the summer since I was a kid, was watch the Met game, you know?
Yeah.
And I would get to like the third inning and I would just be like cringing and I'd be nauseous and I would just go off to my room and like try as hard as I could to fall asleep. And the best I felt those days was like the 7 or 8 hours that I would sleep every night. Like that was the only time I felt like free from this drug.
That's tragic, man. Yeah. I'm sorry that you had to go through that.
Yeah, it was a bad couple of years, but luckily, like I said, I found a new doctor who knew that that was overkill. Like when I first went into him, he was like, wow, he's like, they really got you saturated on this stuff. And, he's like, it's going to take time. And it took a few years, but we slowly like got off of it over a few years, like coming down like 10% every few months for like a couple of years. Luckily today I just need like the Seroquel, and that takes care of insomnia and bipolar, and I've been doing well
I take Seroquel as well.
Cool.
We are going to have to take our first break. You're listening to Voices for Change 2.0. And here is Preston Wiggins with Animal.
Give me a break. The city is a jungle. Make a mistake. But cut them out. Come take a bite. I'll be crying at the moon all night. I'll be the one city. You'll be the hunter. You're just an animal. I'm just an animal. Red blooded love, the rolling thunder. I'm just an animal. You're just as wild. Feel the temperature rise, I can smell you set for miles. Get territory, you can play the predator now. I don't need a compass, babe, I know which way you're going.
I'll be the one to be, you'll be the hunter. You're just an animal, I'm just an animal. Red blood, love, the rolling thunder. I'm just an animal, you're just
Welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. We are here today with Joe Fusaro, and thanks for being with us, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure.
Absolutely. So we're going to dive back into the questions here. When did you decide to begin speaking for NAMI?
So I showed up, it wasn't too long ago, last year. I had heard about, I'd done the This Is My Brave thing, and then I like went a little while without being an active advocate. Like I was doing writing and stuff, but I wanted to like get out and do it in person. So I was like, let me go to the NAMI walk, which they have in Rye, which actually this year is on May 20th, if anyone in the area wants to go down, because I wanted to like meet people in person that had gone through similar experiences as me, or I felt like the internet was good to like get the conversation going, but like everybody felt so far away, you know, like I had like friends in California and Virginia and Michigan, and, you know, all over the map, but like I didn't have anybody in my hometown. So I went to the walk with like a $20 donation, and you honestly don't even need a donation. And I did the walk, which is, it's not far. And at the end, I went up to a woman that looked like she was in charge of something. And I was like, listen,
you look important.
She was doing a lot of things. She was going table to table, talking to people. I was like, she looks like she knows what's going on here. And I said, listen, I spoke for an organization called, and she goes like, This Is My Brave. And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah. She's like, I know you. She's like, I went to that show. So she like knew who I was. And I was like, well, if you guys ever need any help, like speaking at high schools and stuff, like that's what I want to do. Like, that's what I love to do. And she was like, yeah, I'll get you in contact with the right person. And couple months later, I got an email to go to a certification class, went to the certification class, and I started doing it, I guess, the end of August this year.
Cool. Yeah, I had the timeline wrong. I thought you started that first and then went to This Is My Brave, so forgive me for having the timeline off there.
No, don't worry about it. It's kind of back and forth with a lot of things. Like, I had written for the NAMI national site a couple times, like before all, you know, before I got into doing the speeches locally. So it's kind of all over the place.
The kind of interview.
But that's what I do best.
So when did you become a part of This Is My Brave? And can you tell our listeners more about what it is?
This Is My Brave is an organization by an amazing friend of mine, Jen Marshall. And after she was suffering with some mental health conditions, she was like, this is, you know, basically ridiculous that no one's talking about it. So she started a blog, and then she was like, you know what, like there's so many talented people, you know, like writing stories, doing music, doing poetry. Like she's like, if I could just give them a voice and get them up on stage, like that, you know, that's what needs to happen. Like, because we could, our audiences can like feel it, like, you know, heart to heart, like this is what I went through. This is what it feels like, you know, minus all like the arguments that come along with it, minus all like the stigma and all that stuff. It was just like somebody just like up on stage, like spilling their guts and saying like, this is what it feels like. So yeah, now she does shows. I think she started with one show in like the DC or Virginia area, which is where she, you know, where the company's based out of. And now I think this year she's like up to like 12 shows already or something like that, all over the country.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's unbelievable how much it's grown. It was like year one was like one or three shows, and it's like doubled every year. I recently saw she did a high school show and a college show now. So it's expanding. And that was honestly one of the best experiences of my life. I went down and auditioned, which was scary as hell because I hadn't really talked to anybody in years, let alone like read my work in front of people. And, you know, I don't want to say judged because, you know, that's one thing they're good at. They don't judge you. But, you know, when you're auditioning for a show, like, that's what it feels like. Mm-hmm. And then from that, they called me and said that I made it. And, like, that day of the show, like, I was a wreck because the show didn't start until, like, you know, maybe 5 o'clock at night or something. And you have to be down there early, and I was just pacing and, like, going and getting, like, decaf cups of coffee. And anybody who knows me knows that I drink regular coffee 3 times a day at least. But, like, this day, I was like, I can't even handle coffee. Like, that's how nervous I was.
Yeah, when you're dealing with something like that, you know, you get all those thoughts start racing through your head. Oh, what if I screw up? What if I this? What if I that? And it's hard to get out of your own way, you know?
Yeah, Joe and I were just talking about that last night. I think it was last night. We were speaking about when he, you know, played out with a band for several years. And I was telling him how I would just get nervous, like, before the bar even had, you know, 10 people in it, and, you know, way before the show would start, if I climbed the stairs to get up on stage to help him with his equipment, I would get nervous just being on the stage like that.
That's how
crazy bad I am with being in front of groups. So where do you think your courage comes from to speak in front of large groups about something so sensitive?
I don't know, because if it was something that I wasn't passionate about, like, I don't think that I could. Like, I was never really big. Like, when it comes to music, like, I love writing music, and I love just, like, hanging out with my friends and, like, picking up, like, an acoustic and just, like, hanging out. But, like, I never was really into it, for me, into, like, the entertainment aspect. Like, for me, that always just wasn't my thing. Like, I love to go to concerts. I absolutely love it. Like, concerts and sporting events is, like, my thing. Like, I don't go to the bar. I don't go, you know, anywhere else. But for some reason, like, the whole entertainment aspect of music never really appealed to me. It was always, like, the writing process and, like, the recording situation and, like, you know, what was that person going through at that time kind of thing. And, like, how did they use the art to break out of it? And that was more important to me than, like, putting on a show. And so I don't know, I guess because it's something where I could, like, pass on a message, and it's not like people are like, ooh, like, he told a story, but it's like, the kids are like, wow, like, I get that. Or, like, I had a group of alternative students that were just like, oh, my God, finally, like, we came to school and didn't have to listen to, like, some teacher with a ton of degrees just, like, preaching at us. Like, it was they're like, I've been in the hospital. And, like, they were okay with it. You know, these were kids, and they were okay with that. And I think that's what makes me keep doing it. You know, it's just be able to connect with these people and show them,
right,
like, listen, don't be afraid to seek help like I was. Like, just do it. Get yourself right, because that's all that really matters, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's awesome. You know, that's so great that you're connecting with, you know, especially these kids on that level, because you're right on with that. You know, they're so used to being preached at by all these people that have degrees and, you know, PhDs and all this junk. And, you know, for you to come in, you know, and I'm sure you look at it the way I look at it. You know, I'm just a guy, you know, I've gone through these experiences, and, you know, here's what I can relate to you about what I've been through, you know, and it just,
I think
it connects better, you know, and that's so great that you're doing that for them.
You know, and I think it's so important to reach out to kids before they get, you know, jaded and sarcastic about life, and, you know, when they may be going through situations where they're getting bullied. I mean, that's why, you know, I started a petition to get mental health awareness courses to be mandatory in school.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, no.
yeah, I really hope that I can get some more signatures. I took a little bit of a break from posting about it because I was feeling like everybody was kind of getting fed up with it, but I've started posting it again and definitely added some signatures. And, you know, I may never get, you know, to 100,000, but at least I tried, you know, to get it out there and to get people thinking about it.
You know what I've learned over the last couple of years with social media is that one person that totally gets you is 1,000 times better than 1,000,000 people that are just like, oh, she's cool, but like has no idea what you're all about and has like no connection to you. Like, so don't really worry about numbers because we'll all make ourselves crazy on the internet worrying about numbers,
yeah, right.
friends, followers, likes, all that stuff. All that stuff is insignificant. I mean, a lot of the most famous people buy that stuff anyway, you know, so don't even worry about that. If you hit home with one or two people, like go with that, and then that'll turn into more people, and then theirs will spread. And so it's better to go with the one right person is what I'm saying than like 100,000 or 1,000,000 people that just, you know, just think it's like a fad. You know, so.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, you want that meaningful
interaction.
Right, interaction. You want it to go somewhere with that, you know, and just having thousands upon thousands of people, they're like, oh, well, whatever, you know, and they don't take it seriously or.
Right.
Whatever.
And then they forget the next day. So, you know,
right.
You look at these people's pages sometimes, it's like they got like 25,000 retweets or whatever. And it's like they don't remember anything that they did a month ago.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, but you get somebody that, oh, I you know, they respond back, I completely feel the same way and all that, you know, or I've been through that same thing, you know, it's
that's why we all do what we do, is
right
for those people that we do actually reach. So that's
exactly.
You know, all of us have such important messages that, you know, we need to get out to everybody.
Yeah, that connection thing. And I want to say really quick, Joe, you were talking earlier about, you know, your outlook with music and, you know, being able to connect with the artist as far as, you know, where their head was at when they wrote this or they recorded it, and you were more worried about that than putting on a show per se. And I get that. I totally get that, because it's I kind of look at a lot of the things with music the same way. It's like at this point, you know, I don't get me wrong, I miss playing out and I miss performing in front of people, but I miss even more just creating music, getting together with my friends and collaborating and, you know, writing something that the world hasn't heard before and, you know, enjoying it, you know, and, you know, or purging my demons in that process, you know, just all sorts of different things. And that is almost a better situation than at this point in my life anyway, than getting out in front of people and playing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
although it is
know
fun,
what?
I don't want to take anything away
from
the performance. Like, I remember those days were fun, but that was a long time ago for me. Like, so maybe
it was fun. It was a lot of work too. You know, I mean, I'm 5.5 years removed from my last professional show, and I remember it was great, but it was also a grind because I had equipment issues that night, and that hasn't left me 5 years later. So.
Oh, yeah.
Well, on that note, pardon the pun.
But don't bump.
I'll be here all week. Try the veal.
Tip your waitress.
Don't forget to tip your waitresses. We're going to take a quick break here. You're listening to Voices for Change 2.0. Here is Tom Goss, All My Life.
All my life, I've said goodbye to that I know to the truth. But you're my life, so I'll die, try to hold on to. said goodbye to that I know to be true. But you're my light, so I'll try to hold on to you. Oh, 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 oh,
welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. I'm Joe, she's Rebecca, and we're talking to Mr. Joe Fusaro of This Is My Brave and a well-known speaker of NAMI and just an overall awesome dude, and we're so happy that he's spending time with us today. So thanks for being with us, Joe.
I love you, this show so far. So spending time with you, you know, it's like we're just hanging out, so.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, that's the goal.
Yeah, that's really what, pardon me losing my voice again, that's really what we're kind of going for. You know, we don't want anybody to feel strained or under pressure or uncomfortable in any way. You know, it's like when I reach out to, you know, celebrities or whatever, the first thing I say is, you know, we're not TMZ.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right,
we're just...
Right, right.
We're just trying to get to the truth in the most positive way possible. So, Joe said, we're very glad to have you with us.
Yeah, we're going to hold off on digging up all the dirt later with you.
So I think I said to Rebecca the other day, it's like, we have that girl on the line from 2006 or something.
Yeah.
I was like, oh.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're getting ready to spring her on you.
You are not the father.
I think so.
Yeah. So, hey Joe, you've written several books. Would you like to talk a bit about them and where people can find them? And do you have anything new?
Yeah, sure. So I have a few books on. They're on Amazon, or you can find them on my site, unreadletters.com. And basically, after the This Is My Brave show in, I want to say 2014 or 2015, I decided, I was like, that's it. I was like, it like sparked, you know, a little confidence in me. It was like, I shouldn't keep all this inside. Like, I'm going to show, like, I just really got into, like, the good parts of recovery, like, where I was over the hump of like feeling extremely depressed and tired and like weighted down by doctors and meds and isolation and everything. And I was just at like a point where like I started like making up with all my friends. I started going to family events again. Like I was feeling a little better. And I was like, why don't I, you know, instead of digging up like all like the terrible years I had, because that was like my original goal, was I'm going to write this book to show everybody how bad my life was like 10 years ago. And I was like, well, why don't I just start here and then show everybody that like it can get better. And I really, it's, you know, it's not like a story written about what I went through, but it's, I guess from the poetry, you could see like my mindset went from, you know, I start a little back. I probably start like after my last hospitalization in 2013. And you just see like, from the mania and anger kind of turns into like a place of peace and a little bit of acceptance with, you know, my past and what has happened and just trying to move forward kind of thing. So I guess some people call them chapbooks, like, you know, so they're each like about a 6 month to a year portion of my life from like 2013 till now.
That sounds really inspirational, man. That's great.
Yeah, definitely.
Sounds like a good read.
It feels better to put out good stuff, you know, put out a positive vibe and like a little sense of hope, where I feel like if I put out, you know, like the last days of Joe Fusaro kind of thing, like it wouldn't have felt right. You know, it wouldn't have felt right. Yeah. Like leaving people that are in a dark place, like hanging in that place. So that was the motivation for it.
That's really good. Do you have, I'm at a loss. Sorry. I completely lost my train of thought. I was going to ask you something and it went out the window. Getting old's a bitch.
Yeah.
you guys aren't that old. Come on.
I ain't that young, man. I tell you.
I personally didn't fall asleep until after 4 a.m. So if I sound groggy or a little bit out of it, that's why. And if he sounds groggy or a little bit out of it, that's just because
that's just
him.
Me. Yeah.
Hey, it was Friday night. You got to do what you got to do on a Friday night.
There wasn't much that got done on a Friday night. I got new shorty. It was, no, I'm old. No, at this point, she's doing a hell of a lot better than I am. But
so let's talk a little bit more about your poetry and how you got into that. When did that start for you?
That was the same. I guess like writing the lyrics is probably like a little different, you know. But that's probably where the writing started when I was like 13 or 14. And then when I was in college, in and out of college, in like 2003, 2004, like I was just going through some really stressful times. And I was having trouble deciding if I wanted to stay in a job that I didn't really like, but, you know, probably had a chance to like move up in, or if I was going to like just take the money I had made in the last year and a half and go back to school. And it was just kind of like this internal battle like I was having with myself for a couple of years. And I started writing, and I picked up like an acoustic guitar for the first time in probably like 7 or 8 years. And I just started playing and writing, like, and that was like my therapy at that time. So then it would come and go, you know, depending on which meds I was on or which hospital I was in. Like there was times where, that's when I think my writing was either extremely manic or extremely depressing, you know, which explains the manic depression. And then, after a hospitalization in like 2010, 2011, like I kind of stopped, like when I was on the whole, when I was doing the Haldol thing for a couple of years, because I couldn't even think of anything to write. And then as I slowly started coming off of that, I felt like the urge to write again, but I felt like a lot more at peace with writing, and it didn't need to be something that I went at with like this like avant-garde like tenacity. Like, you know, there was nowhere to get from it. It was just like, let me just be and write about what is and not what I'm afraid of and not what, you know, has brought me down in the past. It was like, let me just write about what's really happening and
kind of in the moment.
Yeah. So
very cool.
I wrote a lot of poetry, and I think I was talking with you about this earlier this week. I wrote a lot of, I don't know, I hesitate to use this word, but like emo poetry when I was in high school, like everything was so woe is me, that man done me wrong kind of stuff. And
I have a lot of that. It's okay.
I probably wrote until I would say it was at least 23 or 24. And then suddenly just the plug got unplugged on me. I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't, formulate a sentence, let alone do, an entire poem. So I was really grateful when I got out of the hospital in 2013 that I was able to even string sentences together. So, I'm always impressed by people who can do the whole creative and writing and everything when they're struggling the most, because that's when I find it the hardest to actually put pen to paper.
Yeah, and that's funny because there were times where, I would go days and days without writing, but then there would just be things that I needed to get out, and I think the difference was in my 20s, I would get it out and then I would just kind of sit in it and wallow in it and be disgusted by what I had put on paper. And now I try and figure out, even if I go back to it, I try and figure out what was wrong and what can I do to change that? And that was instrumental in me being able to write again, because, when you go into the hospital with bipolar or when you go to rehab, for substances, one of the things they tell you is that you may never be allowed to play guitar again or drums again or write again, because this may be something that brings up too many terrible memories and feelings and emotions. And I was really scared of that, because I didn't want to lose writing and guitar, but I wanted to be able to learn to live with both of them in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, I get that.
Yeah,
I get
definitely.
That. I think and then the rest of your life is a struggle to find that balance and keep that balance. But I feel this is the best I've ever felt about it.
You're on a good path with it now.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah,
that's very good. And you know what? Really quickly, we're running low on time, but I remembered something that I wanted to give you the opportunity to speak about, and that's your Brave Chat on the first Wednesday of each month, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you were on it last time. That was awesome. So we do, with This Is My Brave, which is at This Is My Brave on all the social media platforms, but on Twitter, on the first Wednesday of every month, with This Is My Brave, I host or facilitate, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you guys do all the work. I just throw up some questions and we just talk about mental health. We talk about, different therapies that worked for you. We've done one on triggers. We've done them on so many different topics that I think we're even starting to go through them again. But it's really just a safe place for people to go and talk about mental health. And we have a very non-judgmental group. People come from all different backgrounds all over the country. We've even had some international people sneak on there and, it's really just a place where you can go, because, I mean, I know for me, when I was struggling, this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I would go on the computer and look up, bipolar. And all it was, a few people, judging each other, or talking about how they're doing it wrong, or only my way works, and only my way works. It's just come on, everybody is different, meds are different, therapies are different, the things that you have to do are different, everybody just lives a different life. So Brave Chat is just an all-inclusive place where you can go and talk about mental health once a month. So
everybody's
and
comparing notes.
For anybody that's listening that hasn't participated in a chat like this on Twitter, and isn't exactly sure how it works, it's actually very, very simple. You don't have to go into a chat room or anything like that. You just kind of log on to your account and you watch for hashtag Brave Chat to start popping up. And there'll be questions, there'll be responses, and then you respond. And then there's also what you can do is in the box at the top of the screen, where you can search for something. You can search for hashtag Brave Chat. And when you do that, it will bring up all the discussion right there in front of you, so you can retweet and like and everything. So if you haven't done it before, it's very easy. It's very therapeutic. It's great to be able to get your emotions out there. And, you know, we appreciate that you host that on the first Wednesday of every month, Joe.
Yes. And I feel like it's a good hub to find people that are doing the same things as you're doing, like whether it's you're dealing with an illness or you're helping a friend or family with an illness, or, you know, like it's just a hub for people to like find each other that are doing similar things. Cause mm-hmm. one thing I found that with the social media is that I needed to surround myself with people that were interested in the same things and, you know, making positive changes and wanted recovery and stuff like that. Because if I just followed, you know, this famous person and this news organization, like it's too scattered for me. Like I want to follow people and be immersed in people that have similar interests. So I think that Brave Chat is a good place to go to like find good people that are doing things that you're doing.
Absolutely.
Very
and,
cool.
You know, with that, unfortunately, we are out of time with Joe for today. It's been great having you on. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule and your Saturday morning to be here with us.
Yep. And we definitely want to have you on again, Joe. It's been a great conversation and it's been a lot of fun. And, you know, we want to definitely keep tabs and keep everybody up to date with what's going on with you out there, too.
Yeah, and stay in touch. If you need any help from us, just shoot me an email or shoot me a message on Twitter, whatever you like. Just keep in touch with
you guys.
Thank you. Thanks. And
I'll be in touch about music stuff, too, by the way.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. that's a promise and a threat.
Yeah, so. Yeah, more a threat, but...
All right. You've been listening to Voices for Change 2.0. We thank you for being here. And this is Trevor Page's Warrior.
There's nothing that I wouldn't do. I'll always fight.
Join us next week as Rebecca and Joe continue to battle the stigma of mental illness. Follow us on Twitter at Voices for Change RJ and on Facebook at Voices for Change 2.0.